From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Nicole Chung is joining us to talk about her acclaimed memoir about being a Korean girl adopted by a white Catholic family in Southern Oregon. It's about her desire to be loyal and committed to the family story that her race didn't matter. But when she was going to have a child of her own, Chung wanted to know more about her culture and the birth parents who gave her up. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you were adopted as a kid, there's often this ongoing conflict in your mind about your birth parents. Part of you wants to find them, not just to ask what happened, why they decided to give you up, but to meet them, see if you act like them, look like them. The other part of you can feel disloyal for this. It's the part of you that knows biology is only one small piece of being a parent and that your adoptive parents were the ones who were there for you. It gets more complicated if your adoptive parents are white and you're not. The writer Nicole Chung has a memoir that explores all of this. She's Korean. Her parents are white conservative Catholics who raised her in Southern Oregon. She tells the story of searching for her birth family. And it won't be giving away too much to say she found them, or they found her. She established a relationship with a birth sister, Cindy, met her birth father, talked to her birth mother. And part of what Nicole needed that she couldn't get from her adoptive family, no matter how supportive or loving, was a cultural identity. Nicole Chung joined us yesterday to talk about her book. It's called All You Can Ever Know. She's a writer and an editor, editor-in-chief of Catapult magazine, has written for publications like The New York Times, The Atlantic, and GQ. She joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. And the memoir is the first time she's told her personal story of being adopted, though she's been writing about adoption for years.
It took me several years to even begin writing about it for myself, actually, and sharing those early pieces with a few trusted friends. Most of the events in the book took place a decade ago or more, and I didn't really start writing about them until about 4 or 5 years after I searched for my birth family. So I sort of had time to percolate a little bit, and even after I started writing, you know, it would be another year or two after that, at least, before I started publishing essays about it. I never really expected to write a memoir, to tell you the truth. Growing up, I wrote a lot of fiction. Even in college, when I took creative writing classes, I was largely focused on fiction and poetry. I wrote some really bad poetry. And so, you know, I didn't discover nonfiction, creative nonfiction, until like my late 20s. And when I first began writing about adoption specifically, I remember being just really surprised by the reactions. A lot of people were intrigued, I think, because they had not read much about adoption from the perspective of an adopted person. By and large, you know, in the mainstream sort of conversation around adoption, the adoptee perspective isn't necessarily the one you hear most often, particularly, like, I think, transracial adoptees. It's a underrepresented perspective. And so I got a lot of really good questions, actually, and it seemed like every essay for, you know, for everyone who said, thank you so much for sharing this, this was, you know, this was interesting, I'd get some other very good questions that would make me think maybe this is another essay, maybe this is something else I could address. And ultimately, it just didn't feel like I'd have the space going piece by piece, sort of essay by essay, to tell the whole story, you know, in all of its nuance and really do justice to everybody. Everybody in my family, my families, I should say. And as for why memoir, say, as opposed to fiction, maybe, there was a time when I sort of considered approaching this maybe more as fiction informed by my experiences as an adoptee, as somebody who searched for her birth family. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I think, again, because it was a perspective that was so underrepresented, because I didn't get to read many accounts about adoption by adoptees, like growing up or as a young adult, to me, there was something kind of powerful in this idea of a transracial adoptee talking about adoption, sort of telling, you know, my individual truth about it as the truth. And I also knew that anybody reading a novel by me about this issue might just assume it was autobiographical, even if it wasn't.
True.
Right. So in that sense, I was like, well, you know, maybe this is just I was feeling by then very comfortable with the essay form. And I thought, you know, maybe it's a book of essays. Maybe it's a memoir.
Yeah. Why do you figure it is that you weren't seeing adoption stories told by people who themselves were adopted? What do you think that was? You've talked about that. I wonder what that's about.
I truly don't know. You know, as I mentioned in the book, I was kind of hungry for those narratives and those perspectives growing up because I didn't know very many adoptees at all. I wasn't close to any. And there just weren't a lot of people I knew who shared my experience who I could talk to about it, frankly, which is not to say that I expected another adoptee's experience to be exactly like mine. Of course, our experiences are only our own, right? But I sort of missed having those mirrors in literature. And it seems as though adopted people in literature, you know, it's very common for us to not make it out of like babyhood or toddlerhood. You know, we're these objects of like desire maybe on the part of parents who want to adopt, or, you know, we're a problem that has to be solved. Yeah. But we don't really grow up, we don't really have that agency that characters have when they are adults in the world. We're thought of kind of as these perpetual children in a way. And so, you know, as for why I didn't see these stories in literature, I still kind of wonder why. I think it's starting to change a little bit. I think I'm hopeful that we'll see more and more of these stories and more, just more adoptees kind of telling their story from their perspective.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned in the book, it was never a family secret that you were adopted. I mean, obviously, obvious reasons. But also, they never really sprang it on you one day. It was always just one of those things that you knew and that you understood. So there was that kind of transparency and honesty, it seemed. But there's also then what you refer to as kind of the first story you can recall about this. And you say in the book that this is the story that would shape 100 others, that your birth parents, you had been told, had just moved here from Korea, and they thought they wouldn't be able to give you the life that you deserved. Now, I wanted to ask you, what are the characteristics in that story? I mean, as you understand it. I mean, part of it is myth, not just incomplete, not really true, but it seems like it's almost a motif, that story. Would you talk a little bit about that, if you will?
It's definitely true. The theme I think of most often when I think of that sort of bare bones original story, and I knew very little at all, you know, what you just said in a sentence, that's really kind of the extent of what I knew as a child.
Yeah.
And as a child, I couldn't really analyze that or pick it apart. I couldn't even really see all the gaps. I didn't even really ask, you know, if we don't know anything about them, and we didn't, if we didn't have any contact, how are you sure this is the story? How are you sure that's what they wanted? But when I think about it now, I realize I really was kind of fed this this ideal of them is this hardworking immigrant ideal, really. And I think that's really the motif that no one called it that by name, you know, that's not like the terminology anybody would have used to talk about it with me. But I heard things about how, you know, my adoptive parents were fairly sure they owned a small business. They were trying to get off the ground at the time I was born. You know, they were working these long hours, 14-hour days on their feet and, you know, didn't have health insurance. So what could they possibly do with a child like me who'd been born 10 weeks early?
Yeah.
The whole story had this sort of air of noble tragedy that I didn't really think to question, you know, because it was also presented as this was meant to be, you know, this was fate. We were meant to adopt you. You were meant to be ours. And so this always had to happen. And it really wasn't until I got older, my mid to late teens, is when I really started to sort of question if this is really all we know, how are we sure it's the truth? Could there be more to this? And you know, I've stopped believing in it, I think, as fate around that age, too, because I began thinking of my birth parents as real people, not just these mythical figures who had to go through this ordeal in order for my adoptive family to adopt me. I started to think a lot more about their agency or lack thereof, maybe, and what they had wanted. And in a way, I'm embarrassed it took till my teens, but it really did, I think, for me to begin to question that.
So interesting. It seems like there was a kind of, you were all complicit in this story, and you all had this kind of script that, I mean, one of the things that you say is that you were constantly asking your mother, how could they, my birth parents, have given me up? And the answer was always, look, they thought adoption was the best thing for you. Mm-hmm. And it was expected that you would play your part here. And your answer was always, it seems like, part of the script almost, they were right, Mom. Mm-hmm. This is the best thing for me. Talk a little bit about that part. This is almost part of the lore, right? The story.
Right. I mean, I think when you're a small child, and I was, you know, I don't remember the first time I learned I was adopted. Yeah. I don't remember those early conversations you mentioned earlier. It was just something I always knew that we'd always talked about. You're given these stories, kind of fed them, and it's not that they're lies. I don't believe anybody was trying to mislead me. Just because we didn't have the full truth doesn't mean what they tried to tell me was a lie. It's just that, you know, as a small child, you're not really questioning those foundational stories you're given. It's interesting, too. Too, because even as you get older and begin to see the holes in them and the places where, you know, probably we're guessing, we don't really know, I think those stories still have like enormous power over us. I think they can be very hard to let go of because they're familiar, because they're comforting. I knew when my adoptive parents were trying to comfort me by saying, well, they really wanted you. They couldn't keep you and they really thought this was the best thing. I knew even as a young child, part of my job really was to comfort them too, and to say, like, to reassure them I loved them and I felt secure in our family, and to say, you know, I'm sure you're right, like, I'm sure this was the right decision. It's just interesting, like, again, it wasn't something they asked me to say. It was just something I think as kids we all kind of learn those responses from our parents. You know, when we have these familiar conversations over and over again, I think we learn what we're expected to say, even how we're expected to feel. And as kids, we often try to respond to that, to meet adults' expectations. It can really feel like our job.
You say the story demanded, when you were little, you figured the story demanded your trust and your loyalty. Mm-hmm. But then you talk about also confess to having these, from time to time, doubts about the story. Tiny traitorous doubts is how you refer to it in the book. What's going on there?
I think some of those doubts arose, you know, probably starting in adolescence, continuing throughout my teens into young adulthood. And again, a lot of it really was about thinking about my birth family more, thinking about everything from their perspective. I wrote in the book, I grew up in a religious family, and my parents would often, it wasn't that my adoption was just fate. It was like ordered by God. Yeah. It was divine intervention in our lives. It was God's will. And I, you know, I knew they believed this really strongly. And even though, you know, I was raised religious, I wasn't raised to question these things. I think I always had this little, I don't know if it was a streak of rebellion or what, but like skepticism. I remember thinking at some age, like in my teens, well, you know, if my birth parents wanted to keep me, why didn't God care about what they wanted? You know, I don't, and I realized I didn't think of God as like that sort of puppet master, like not when it came to designing families and which parents would have to give a child up or feel they had to, and which parents would get that child. You know, I think that was just, that really proved to be for me a theological step too far. And so that's kind of one of the doubts. And then once you start down that path, in a sense, there's no going back. Even if you try not to think about it, you're going to continue to have these questions and these doubts. And the doubts had nothing to do with my adoptive family's love for me. I always felt very secure in that. And in mine for them, it was just like, there's more to this story, probably. Like, there was a whole other family here. What happened to them? And so I think that's really the source of a lot of the doubt and the questions.
Can I get something out of the way? Parents, okay. Birth parents, adoptive parents. Mm-hmm. Like, let's talk about the language there, because it's kind of, it's interesting. I was thinking about something that a classmate had said of yours when you were really young and said, you know, do you ever want to know who your real parents are? And I think kids who are adopted hear that from time to time.
Absolutely.
How do you handle that question of parents, birth parents, adoptive parents? Just say something about that, because I think that's interesting.
It's interesting. So when I use those terms, those qualifiers, they are almost always for the benefit of other people. Yeah. In the book, they're there for the benefit of readers. You know, it might be clear from inference who I'm talking about, but I might still say it's my birth father, you know, not my adoptive father, so people aren't confused. The most bizarre thing, too, has been this past year, I've been grieving my father, my adoptive dad, who passed away while I was finishing up the book, actually. And I found myself saying, like, to people, you know, my dad passed away. And then I realized, like, I pretty much had to qualify every time with most people. I mean, my adoptive dad. And that felt very strange because it was, I mean, of course, in my head, he's just my dad. Like emphasizing that, especially when I'm talking about how much I miss him, seems very strange, right? And kind of unnatural because that's not how I think of him. But I realized for it to be clear to other people which parent had died, I had to add that term. And so, I thought about that a lot in the book. In real life, you know, I will just kind of use the terms interchangeably. I'll say my parents and I don't qualify it. But when I'm writing, I realize people are unfamiliar with my life, of course. And they're unfamiliar with these relationships. And so I have to add those terms so they can understand who I'm talking about.
Nicole Chung, her book is All You Can Ever Know. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's Community Calendar is a resource where you can find hundreds of events happening across Utah. You can learn a new skill in workshops, experience art and performances offered across the state, scout family-friendly events and activities, and a whole lot more. You can also share your own events. Just fill out the form. It's all on our website, KUER.org. Just click Community Calendar under the Events tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Nicole Chung talking about her memoir, All You Can Ever Know. It's about being a Korean girl adopted by a white Catholic family in Southern Oregon. It's about her desire to be loyal and committed to the family story that race didn't matter. So you tell the story about them making their way from the Midwest, from Cleveland to the Northwest, where you were raised, and they end up in Seattle ultimately. And at first, they weren't that interested in organized religion, but then through a kind of a nice story, they end up back in Catholicism, back in the fold, as you put it. They felt like, as you say, that they came to see God move in their lives, and so that was important to them. I think that's an important kind of perspective. And they had always planned to have children. You know, they had big Catholic families, so I'm sure that was part of just the way they had thought about it. But they couldn't have children. And then they get word about you, a premature baby at a Seattle Children's Hospital. And I want to ask you about the moment they learned the baby was Korean, that you were Korean. What effect do you think that had on them? Because you write about this in the book.
Yeah. So by the time they heard about me, it's true, I was born in Seattle and I was at the Seattle Children's Hospital because I had been in the neonatal intensive care unit for several months. My adoptive parents by then had moved to Southern Oregon, which is why I grew up there in a fairly small white community. Yeah. But they had maintained ties to Seattle. And so it was friends of theirs still in Seattle who told them about me. And it's interesting. So, like, when they heard I was Korean, they always told this part of the story with, like, a shrug. Like, it couldn't have mattered less to them. And I've always just kind of accepted that it probably didn't really matter much to them. You know, I don't think they're putting that on. I don't think they were lying about that. I think it didn't make much of a difference to them. They really wanted a child. Like, and especially the whole, you know, the idea of being told about me by friends who they'd known back in Seattle. The whole story to them just felt like, again, like it was meant to be, you know? And so my race didn't matter that much to them. I think that what gave them greater pause was the fact that they didn't know how healthy I would be or how much help I would need. And so I do know they spent some time really thinking about that. But yeah, in the end, it was interesting. Their main hesitation was regarding my race, I think, was just sort of talking to their parents about it and making sure it wasn't going to be like an issue and that people wouldn't say anything like inappropriate to me growing up in our family because, there was no one else in the family who would look like me. And so I think they wanted to just prepare everybody.
Yeah. And it's interesting, for years and years you held to this. This is how you describe it in the book, this sacred pact in the family, that the idea of your race didn't matter because we love you and you were meant to be here. So that, so why should that matter? I mean, that was the pact that you were to understand. Talk a little bit about how that started to not unravel, but how you started to question that.
Sure. I should note, too, that part of the reason they raised me to really believe that my race didn't matter was not just because it didn't matter to them in terms of their love for me. Yeah. It was my parents, before they adopted me, you know, they spoke with a social worker. They spoke with an adoption attorney. They had an agency that did their home study. And they talked with the judge who finalized my adoption. And no one said, her race actually matters. You should talk about this. Here are some resources. It's interesting. I mean, they did ask at several points, and at each and every point, you know, these experts who they trusted told them, don't worry about it. It's irrelevant. The judge said, assimilate her into your family. Everything will be fine. My mother told me later, like years later, this isn't in the book, but she said, I really thought they would recommend a book at least, you know, something. Right. There was nothing. They weren't given really anything. You know, as to why that is, it was a slightly different era in adoption. My adoption was classified as sort of like pressing because of my health. I don't think anyone wanted to see it fall through, you know. So, yeah, but anyway, they did try, and that was what they were told. And so I think in large part they were following the lead of experts.
The question that they put to the judge, I think, is kind of funny and sad in some ways. I mean, the day your adoption is finalized, your parents asked the judge, well, do you have any advice? And you say in the book you wonder if he was kind of surprised by that question, or if he got it all the time. But I think it's an interesting moment. You just sort of didn't have much to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I picture like a busy person with a lot of cases on their docket. Yeah, I mean, I wonder how many cases they finalized that day in the family court. And I did. I've always been fascinated sort of wondering, you know, did he really look at them? Did he really think about their individual circumstances? And did he think about mine? Because it's not just about the family adopting. It's about that individual child and what's in their best interest. You know, I always wonder, did he really stop to think about all of that? Was he already very familiar with the details of the case? Or was he asked this all the time and at this point kind of rubber stamping a process that he didn't begin? I truly don't know. There's no way to know an answer. You like to think that these systems that are supposed to serve children, including very vulnerable children, you like to think, of course, that they are always taking into account the individual child's best interest, and then not just the adoptive family, but the birth family as well. And there's truly no way to know exactly what he was thinking, but it doesn't stop me from wondering. And it is a really interesting moment because it was kind of the last, that was my exit from like the Washington state, like child welfare system. That was the last point of contact, the last opportunity for anybody to say, you should talk about this, or here are some things you should know. And once that door closed, I mean, we were on our own for the rest of my childhood, for the rest of our lives and our relationship. That was really the last opportunity anybody had to offer advice.
Yeah.
As for when that started to unravel, when the idea of my race not mattering, this sort of colorblind ideal I was raised with, when that started to unravel, I can pinpoint the day. It was probably the first day I heard a racial slur at school directed my way, and was so confused, had no idea how to react. Didn't have the language to call it a slur or even call it racism. But looking back, it was just this huge moment, like looming in my childhood. You know, I think I fundamentally understood that it was a different sort of mockery, maybe, than like others that I'd experienced kind of in passing. And, you know, it was accompanied with that gesture, sort of that universal gesture I think most Asian Americans know from childhood, of like a white kid pulling their eyes back into slits and mocking you in like a fake Asian accent. And it was accompanied by an Asian slur. And I just remember, like, thinking, my parents always told me the way I look doesn't matter. You know, what matters is the kind of person I am, and what matters is that they love me. But clearly it matters. Like, it's going to matter here at school. It's going to matter among all my white peers, and it's going to matter, like, out in the world. I think that was just the first day where I really thought about how the way certain people would see me would always see me, and how it was not something that I could control, and it was not something my parents could control. And, you know, no amount of love or good intentions was going to protect me from encounters like this. But yeah, that was probably the first like awakening moment where I realized maybe it doesn't matter to my adoptive family, my race, but it's going to matter to me and it's going to matter to other people.
Do you think, Nicole, there's a difference between feeling secure in your adoptive family and feeling like you belong? Because it seems like that difference comes through in your story.
Yeah, I think for me, there's a difference. Again, I can really only speak to my own experience, yeah. And like another adopted person could answer very differently. But for me, I've always felt very secure in my adoptive family, like with my parents, in terms of their love for me and mine for them. You know, that was one thing I never doubted. There have been many points where I think I describe it in the book as feeling like a beloved alien in the family. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes think, and to be clear, I don't think this is all about race either. Yeah. You know, I could be like white like my parents and like still be radically different from them. Or they could be Asian and like we could still have these like sort of insurmountable or things we just don't understand about each other, right? That's family, actually, and that's true in a lot of biological families as well. But I did. I've always felt kind of out of place in my adoptive family, just for various reasons, not all having to do with race or culture. I don't know. Yeah, and it's interesting because one thing I've learned is that you can feel a great deal of love and even security without a total sense of belonging or feeling like I am definitely one of you. You know, I don't know. It sounds kind of sad when I say it out loud, but I don't think of it that way. You know, I'm very thankful for like the love and the security I feel in my adoptive family. And at the same time, yeah, I can't really close my eyes to the ways in which we're different or the ways in which I always felt just a little bit out of place. That's okay. I don't think that just because you love people, you have to deny those things, those differences.
Yeah.
That's a really good question.
They said, your mother once said to you, we weren't really prepared to have a kid like you.
Yeah, she's so frank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what that meant to her. I mean, you were an intense kid, but I wonder, did that at all imply we didn't know what to do with the culture or race part? We didn't know when we started to see this intense kid, if that was a function or a factor of her, you know, yeah. Race or do you know what I mean? Like what they even made of that, which is a weird question, but.
I was the kind of kid who put a lot of pressure on myself for various reasons, like to do well in school. And I was always so focused on like getting out of my small white hometown. Like I probably started thinking about college way before most kids my age in my town, because mm-hmm. There was this idea of escape, you know, that I couldn't quite overlook. I was also my adoptive parents hadn't gone to like a 4-year college. So they didn't have bachelor's degrees. And so in a sense, I was like, I was always, I think, a little bit anxious about it because I was navigating it without, like, the benefit of a family who could really advise me in this area.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was intense. And I know in that conversation, she was referring to my intensity around school. My parents never put any pressure on me academically. Like, they could not have cared at all, like, what grades I brought home, whether I took AP classes or not, where I went to college, if I went to college. It has something to do maybe with not having, like, a strong academic, you know, tradition in their families, and something to do with just their like absolute acceptance of me as a person. Like they never would have been dissatisfied or like disappointed if I hadn't gone on to do these things. Like that wasn't at all what their love or like support of me was contingent on. And I think in that conversation, my mother was sort of frustrated with me because I was stressed probably about, I don't remember specifically, but probably a test or probably grades or maybe college applications. And, you know, I think she just said like, it was in conversation and she just mentioned like, we really weren't prepared for this. This is a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know. She didn't mean it like in an unloving way. It was just kind of the truth. And sure, some of it may have had to do with race and culture. She might have been thinking a little bit about that as well. I don't know if they associated those traits of mine with like Asian culture. I don't remember them ever explicitly like saying that, you know, or like referring to Asian stereotypes in that way. I really don't. But yeah, I mean, it's possible that that was on her mind as well. I think it was just, there were many points like during my childhood and adolescence when they would point out like, you're pretty different from us.
Yeah.
In a sense, that made it like not taboo for me to say the same thing.
Right.
And for all of us to kind of talk about it as a fact and without like bitterness and without it being an attack, you know? So when I talk about feeling different from my adoptive family, that's like not meant to be taken as a judgment of them. Just like when they told me, you're really different from everybody in our family, it wasn't intended to be like a criticism, yeah. I think. Even if it sometimes came out in moments of frustration, I think in general, we just recognize this fundamental truth about our family, that we were pretty different.
Several years ago, you tell the story about meeting a couple who were considering whether they should adopt.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they asked, and it's interesting how they put it.
Yes.
Had you ever minded not being white? And I think a couple of things are interesting about the story. One is what they meant by that, but also the way you answered them then and the way you might answer them now, which I mm-hmm. think would be quite different. But what did you make of the question, if you minded being white?
I remember thinking, I don't know what I'm doing here. I was 22 years old. I wrote in the book, I really didn't even think of myself as a full adult yet. So to be asked essentially advice by people who are about to become parents, something that I could not imagine at that age, mm-hmm. I really did sort of feel out of my depth. And I had also been in college for the past 4 years, and I'd been away from like my adoptive family. I'd been at a university with a lot of Asian Americans as well. So I got really used to blending in. I got used to not having to talk about adoption or explain things unless I wanted to. I was just out of practice, I think, with it. And so, but I was introduced to this couple by mutual friends, and it really was because our mutual friends thought I could reassure them, essentially, like tell them how great it was to grow up adopted in a white family. Like, I think they'd be really comforted talking with you. And I was like, sure, okay, I can do that, because like it was mostly fine and great.
Yeah.
I had never really been asked, though, like, did you mind it, or was there anything bad about it, or did you have any big issues? And I started thinking about it and remembering, again, just some of the stuff I went through at, like, an all-white elementary school, some things that I had never told anybody or had just begun to share with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, actually, yeah, I mean, I just remember thinking I have two choices here. Like, I could tell them the truth and sort of open this messy can of worms that I'm not even sure I'm ready to confront or talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And like, what if that's betraying my adoptive family? Like, what if they think I don't love my parents? Or I could do the easier thing, and maybe the right thing, maybe the moral thing here is for me to just reassure them, tell them what they want to hear, because I was loved and I was thankful and it was mostly fine. And in the end, I really just couldn't bring myself to like open everything up and share everything. It had been years since I had thought about some of these experiences, and I realized I'd never really fully faced them. I hadn't told hardly anybody about them. I wasn't ready to do so with people I just met, especially if, you know, what if it changed their mind about adopting, and like what if I ruined their family before it began? It was just too much pressure. And I think I was too young and uncertain of myself to do much more than just kind of nod and smile and say, everything's going to be fine. You know, this is great. I don't think it was necessarily a lie. It was just, I wasn't really, I mean, and I believed they would be fine, honestly.
Sure.
I thought their family would be okay. It wasn't something I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to confront everything just yet. So, yeah, if I were to answer that question today, you know, I don't think I would say, of course, I think if people read the book, they'll see it's not like I think that nobody should adopt across racial lines. It's, you know, I don't think I would tell. I'm not in the business of telling individual couples to adopt or not adopt. Right. That's a decision for them to make. But I think I'm just a lot more able, and I've had a lot more practice to talk about some of the complicated issues mm-hmm. in transracial adoption in particular, and, you know, some of the conversations they've got to be prepared to have and to start. And I tell them things like, you know, you can really listen to adoptees and try to find birth parent accounts, although those can sometimes be harder to find. But, you know, you need to be aware of these issues if you're going to adopt, and, you know, just really be aware that, of course, you're going to love your children, and maybe their race isn't going to matter a whole lot to you, but it will matter to them.
Yeah.
It will matter out in the world. They will face it in ways you can't quite imagine yet, in circumstances where you're not present. And so how do you really walk with them and support them? How are you going to be their strongest, best allies? How are you going to empathize when you have not had the experience of being a person of color in this country? So those are the kind of things I talk about now. It's not like a straight up or down yes or no kind of question, obviously, should we adopt. But it is one that I do approach differently now than I did, 10 years ago.
There's this really, I have to say for me, this really poignant moment. And it was a few months after you had met your birth father. And we'll talk a little bit. I'm not sure how much you want to give away about that, but I want to come to some of those elements of the story if we can.
Okay.
But it was just a few months after you had met your birth father, and your mom asked you, so I'm guessing she said something like, so honey, what do you think about your adoption now? And she put it this way. She said, do you think it was a good thing? Now, what I thought was so poignant about that is she seemed so vulnerable at that moment, like getting your approval almost. Honey, is this okay? Was this a good thing? Because you say in the book it represented a possibility that you hadn't really before acknowledged. Would you talk a little bit about that particular moment? Because the question of being good or even bad, you think about it in different terms these days.
I do. It's interesting. So I think there's a certain amount of vulnerability whenever I talk to my adoptive parents or they talk to me about adoption, just because, they do love me so much and they want me to feel like happy and secure and loved in our family. And I know when they adopted me, they wanted and expected that would always be enough. So I was really conscious when I was searching for my birth family and sort of beginning to forge these new relationships that I didn't want my adoptive parents to feel like left behind or like certainly not rejected. I didn't really want them to feel I was doing it because of something they lacked. That was not really what it was about. So I remember talking with them, trying to help them understand like why I was searching. And yes, after I'd met people, after I'd met my birth father, I don't remember exactly how long after that, but I think my mom brought it up, my adoptive mom. She asked me, did I think it was the right thing that my birth parents had given me up, or did I think it would have been better somehow if they'd managed to keep me, or if one of them had managed to keep me and raise me? Yeah. And I think she was especially thinking about how then my sister, Cindy, and I, and we've become really close since we reunited. Mm-hmm. I think she was thinking then you and Cindy would have grown up together, and that seems like it would have been really good for both of you. When I think about it, I think about just how far she had to move from sort of her original view about adoption, mine in particular, as like fate and God's will and like always meant to be, nothing else could have ever happened, to the point where she could actually ask me sincerely. And it was not like she was not asking like bitterly or to make me feel guilty or something like that. Yeah. It was a sincere, I think, very curious question, an impossible question to answer, right? But I think to me it showed how far she had moved from that original view and how my view of my birth family had obviously changed since I started learning about and talking with them, but also my adoptive parents' view of them had changed. Like, we all saw them as, like, whole people with their own lives and their own agency or lack thereof and their own tragedies and their own complications. It was not until I started searching for them, honestly, that I fully grasped, like, maybe they weren't so well served by the system that put me in my adoptive family. Yeah. They were a family in crisis. They were going through a lot of hard things. My sister was going through a lot of hard things, and they talked to social workers too. And all the social workers really saw were a hardworking immigrant couple who had decided for whatever reason to give up their child. Mm-hmm. And no one really probed much deeper. Yeah. No one really served them in the process. And I wish I had thought about all of this when I was a kid, but I just think it was hard. It was hard to sort of see that whole side. I don't know. So I started thinking about that, and I think my mother started thinking about it too, my adoptive mother. And that's the source of that conversation for us.
I mean, before you became pregnant, a lot of this was just kind of theoretical and abstract. So once you became pregnant, that must have changed deeply the way you were thinking about all of this.
Oh, definitely. You know, as I wrote in the book, I remember being at that first prenatal appointment and being asked all of these questions about my medical history mm-hmm. that I could not answer. Yeah. You know, I'd gotten used to writing like adopted on that portion of the medical form and right. just like skipping on. And I was young and I was healthy and like, I didn't really think about getting sick or about pregnancy complications or about, it was kind of amazing that the midwife asked me, so why'd your birth mother go into labor so early? Do you know? And I didn't know. And I had actually never, you know, I'd thought about why, but I just figured it was one of those things. Everything turned out okay. I'm sure it was difficult and traumatic, but I was fine. So I hadn't really thought about why. And then it was, for the first time, I started wondering, is this going to happen to me? What if it happens to my baby? Like, do I need to know more in order to try to prevent this somehow? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, part of the reason I searched was also because I was thinking, oh, this practical information could be really important for my kids and for me. I'm getting older. It's a responsible thing to do. Yeah. But also, you know, I don't want to make it sound like it was only practical motivation. Of course, I was also thinking, because I was pregnant, partly, I was thinking a lot about legacy and things that we pass on to our children. Mm. I was thinking about how I would answer my kids' questions someday. And so I just remember thinking, like, I'm not going to have good answers if this child asks me about my birth family, my adoption, like why and how and all of that. Like, I'm not going to know. I'm not going to know the people we came from. You know, how am I going to be able to teach them about like their Korean heritage when I'm completely separated from mine? Yeah. So, you know, that was another reason why I searched. I think an adopted friend of mine said this to me at the time. She said, you know, sometimes we can do things for our kids we can't do for ourselves. And for me, that was definitely true. It's not like I'd never thought about searching before. I had researched the process. But, you know, it was really getting pregnant that was the final impetus to go ahead and do it.
Mm. When you met your birth father, you mentioned that a lot of what-if questions came to mind. You know, who might you have been if your birth father had been the one to raise you?
Sure.
You mentioned how even without his, as you say, his actual influence in your life growing up, it seems like he managed to pass things on. And I just wondered mm-hmm. what all of that has taught you about, you know, there's this ongoing question about, you know, how much nature influences our lives
sure.
versus how much nurture and the environment influences our lives. Have you come to any conclusions about that? Are you still kind of going back and forth on all of that?
I don't think there's there's an easy answer. Certainly like when I think about things my birth father has passed on, the easiest thing to point to is writing. So he is also yeah. a writer. He's an essayist. He's published a book of essays in Korean, actually. And, you know, it's just been a lifelong love of language and words and literature. My birth father's actually, he's very proud of the book. You know, more than once he said, like, you get this from me. I mean, it's true that I didn't get, like, a love of writing from my adoptive family. It just isn't something anybody, you know, in my family did. Mm-hmm. All, like, readers loved books, but just, like, you know, I was the only writer. And so maybe that's one really obvious thing. You know, I've noticed certain little traits. Like, my sister and I, you know, we both kind of have this like thing where we like write on the surface of like the table or whatever with our finger or like draw in the air as we're talking. And like, you know, I think I did that maybe her first night visiting and she like flipped out because she's like, you know, I do that all the time. Like our dad does that too. It's just, you know, it's just one of those funny little things. But yeah, so like in addition to all the physical traits and the things that are really obvious and easy to see, you know, there definitely are some characteristics that seem to be family traits, and writing's probably the strongest one to point to.
How did your parents, how did they react to not just the search for your birth parents, but the book?
Right. So when I decided that I wanted to start writing about adoption and when I decided I wanted to write this book, I had already talked over a lot of this with my adoptive parents. My general rule for the people in the book, actually, was just that I didn't want the book to be the first place they read something.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to be the first place we ever talked about it. So, but we had already, like, years before. I didn't tell my parents, for example, about, like, the racism I experienced mm-hmm. on the playground growing up. I didn't tell them about it when it was happening. I just didn't know how. But, you know, I did tell him about it as a young adult. So I think there were a lot of things that we had already talked about. And to some degree, searching for my birth family kind of forced our hand. I was learning things and I was trying to share things with them. And, you know, they were very excited when I connected with my sister. And so I think that it kind of just forced us to have a lot of conversations. Maybe we wouldn't have ever had them otherwise, but we did. So the book was not the first time that we, you know, there was, as my mother has told me, there were no surprises. And I think they appreciated that. They also had like ample opportunity to read and sort of comment. I showed it to them a good year before publication, as soon as I had a first draft ready. I wanted them to have a chance to ask any questions, voice any concerns, which I know they appreciated, but they didn't really voice any concerns. They were really, I think, moved. I think they're very proud. You know, my adoptive father didn't get to finish reading it, unfortunately, before he passed away, but you know, he did tell me, like, he was reading it around the holidays, and he told me it was a really great Christmas present, you know. And they both really gave me the gift of saying, this is not the book we might have written about your life, and that's okay. Like, it's your life, it's your perspective, it's your experience in our family and growing up, and it's not our experience. So, you know, we don't feel it's our place to really question or say anything is not valid. But they did tell me, in terms of, like, you know, what they could remember, it seemed like the truth to them.
Yeah.
I think they were really glad to have read it, and they both seem really proud. You know, my mom came to one of my readings and she really loved that. So of course I was kind of anxious showing it to them. I'm anxious kind of that it's out in the world at all, to be honest. Like, I'm still getting used to that, but my family was really great and supportive about it. So, yeah, I think they were pleased and proud.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you've talked about is that raising your kids now, you have two kids now, kids of color, and as you say, raising them in, you know, this America of a pretty bitterly divided country has made you feel like you cannot maintain silence about your race with your relatives.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that, if you would, that this is something that, you know, it was always the family pact. We just didn't really say anything. It didn't matter. You were meant for us, but now you feel like you have to... You need to be more vocal about race? Is that what you're saying?
I think so. You know, in that section of the book where I go into that, I think I'm talking also about our political differences.
Yeah.
So, you know, I am... I was raised in a pretty conservative white family in a red corner, or at least more red corner of a blue state.
Yeah.
And my adoptive family and I really don't see eye to eye on certain issues, like a lot of issues. And there was this period where I was changing and I thought they were moving further right. And we didn't talk about it as much because, I don't know. I was living across the country, and when we were together, it was easier to just, like, try to enjoy the time and not argue, which I think a lot of people can probably relate to.
Yeah.
But, like, I think especially now, living, like, you know, in the Trump era, and also being a parent, having kids of color, and just being more conscious of my responsibility and what it means to try to be in solidarity with others and people who are, you know, either similarly or, like, more marginalized, who face different oppressions than I do. You know, I have a responsibility. So even though I love my family, sometimes I think it is my job as the only person of color in my family to sort of be this, I've said it before, like, sort of de facto race ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough role, I'll be really honest. And the reason that, you know, I brought up my children in this context is that from time to time, like, my relatives will say things in front of my kids that I feel I have to push back on because my kids are there and listening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's part of why I do it. And it's, you know, I don't feel able to maintain that silence. It's, like, too dramatic maybe to say, like, it's the price of, like, us being family is that we have to be honest about these
mm-hmm.
things. But it's kind of how I think about it. You know, like, we have this relationship. I do consider myself close to them. You know, I know they love me. And it's safe for me to speak out. It's not always easy. Sometimes it's very frustrating. But, like, I'm not endangering myself by being honest. And so sometimes it does feel like violating this pact that we talked about before in the show about how, you know, my race wasn't supposed to matter and we weren't really talking about it, but they know I don't feel that way anymore. You know, they know it matters a lot to me and that I think about my identity and my kids' identities a lot. And so, even if it's strange for my adoptive family, like, we're going to have those conversations sometimes because I think there really shouldn't be love without some honesty.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it is what it is. And I'm trying to, not all the time, but sometimes trying to look for opportunities to start those conversations.
Let me ask you this finally. I noticed this line in the book. There's a moment when your birth father and his wife are returning home, and you're meeting him at the house of your sister Cindy,
mm-hmm.
your birth father's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You write this. You say, when it was time for them to leave, Cindy's parents hugged her and her family goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you make a distinction. You say her parents. And this is like the last thing you mention in the book, that when you think of the term parents, you're not thinking of your birth parents. I mean, that's the one thing that hasn't really changed. Would you mm-hmm. say something about that finally?
It's not that I don't think of my birth father as like my father. I do think of him as more Cindy's father than mine. I don't think there's any getting around that, just yeah. their shared history and everything. You know, they know so much more about one another than I do. They share this like culture I'm not really part of, like a family culture. And so yeah, it's not that I feel like left out when we're together. I feel like actually very like fortunate to be let in a little bit and to get a chance to know them both. But yeah, it is a different sort of relationship for sure. And then it's true that when I say parents right off the bat, I am thinking of like my adoptive parents as a unit, you know, they are like my default parents. Mm-hmm. and I think that'll always be the case. I still talk about them in the plural, actually, too, even though like my father is dead. Like I still think of them as like that unit. It's just so weird to think about one without the other still. But you know, and it's not that I don't consider my birth father family. I very much consider him family and a parent. But like, if I'm just kind of speaking quickly, not thinking, and I use the term parents, yeah, I'm referring to my adoptive parents.
Yeah. Well, Nicole Chung, thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
That's Nicole Chung. Her book is All You Can Ever Know. She joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.